When David Eby, the NDP Premier of British Columbia, turns around and says, we made a mistake, we need to fix the decriminalization process, you know it hasn't gone well. Hello, welcome to the Full Comment Podcast. My name's Brian Lilly, your host, and today we're going to talk about drug policy, decriminalization, safer supply, issues that are gripping much of the country, not just because they're political, but because of the impacts, both for families dealing with addiction, a loved one who has dealt with addiction or loss, but also because of the impact some of the decisions our politicians are making around drugs are having on our communities. David Eby and the NDP government in BC initially asked for decriminalization of all hard drugs. And less than a year and a half in, they're asking the Trudeau government in Ottawa to recriminalize drugs in public areas. Not completely, but in public areas. Why? Chaos, public disorder, and an outcry from a citizenry that said, this just isn't working for us. Julian Summers is a clinical psychologist, professor at Simon Fraser University, and he deals a lot in the area of addictions, recovery, and monitors what is going on in his home province. Julian, thanks for the time.
It's great to be with you, Brian.
Maybe this is too big a question to ask off the top, but how did things go so badly with decriminalization? I mean, surely some people would have seen the outcomes ahead of time, but Premier Eby said, well, we need safeguards in place, and maybe they should have been there at the start to stop things like drug use in children's playgrounds or on public transit. Did nobody see this ahead of time?
People did see it. It was unpopular to point out limitations of the government's, the BC government's planning. And so many of my colleagues who were concerned and shared my concerns felt pressured to remain silent. And this is due to the organizations that they're working in, whether it's the provincial government itself, our health authorities, and even physicians in private practice were, going back now 3 years when this kind of got started, were saying, gosh, I'm really glad you're speaking out, but I can't. And, it's some kind of a deficiency on my part that leads me to blurt out things. I didn't think that commenting critically on the government's plans would result in such a severe backlash. And now I've got a clear understanding of why that took place. But the policymaking environment here was quite superficially informed by the science of addiction and relevant evidence elsewhere. The single intervention of decriminalization was regarded as kind of a logical next step in light of the limitations of the war on drugs, as though there are no intermediary possibilities. And in her report, our provincial health officer, Dr. Bonnie Henry, when requesting decriminalization, said, decriminalization on its own, without additional measures at this time, will result in improvements because it will lower stigma, which, in my view, is a crazy assertion, and that it'll allow police to focus on other things, so we'll see net improvements. We must follow that, she said, by further increasing the regulation and legalization of illicit drugs. Another crazy idea. It wasn't popular to point these things out, but increasingly the government is being compelled to face the reality that they badly miscalculated.
To me, it seems that British Columbia, like here in Ontario, is Toronto specifically, that the decision-making is being guided by activists more so than thinking things through. In reaction to British Columbia asking for a recriminalization and all the documented social ills that came with it and the fact that police were powerless to do anything, our mayor, our medical officer of health, our provincial chief medical officer, they're all still defending it. What happened in British Columbia? And they're saying that we we need to move forward with this. In fact, Dr. Eileen Davila put out a video the other day defending the policy and the request to the federal government to have decriminalization in Toronto, saying, well, you know, no one will be able to smoke a crack pipe in a playground or shoot drugs into their arm on transit. And then you look at what the request is, and it's clear that they will, because police would only be able to act if someone was smoking a crack pipe or shooting heroin in a childcare center, a K-12 school, or an airport. And outside of that, they would have no ability to deal with someone causing major distress for transit riders, for parents, for small children.
Yeah, it's hard to understand how someone would say that, especially in close proximity to the testimony that we're hearing from police officers and police representatives giving testimony in Ottawa and stating that questions like, well, we hear if patients in hospital are smoking fentanyl and crack in their hospital rooms. Fellow patients are concerned. Police, surely you can do something. And the response is, well, no, we can't. And so it's hard to kind of, imagine, well, why would someone in a position of authority be saying the opposite in advance of a change? And I think we have to look at money. I think we have to look at the fact that whether it's in our municipal politics, our provincial politics, in our academic institutions, that we have increasingly individuals whose livelihoods and whose careers are related to the flow of public funds, whether it's their salaries, their staff support, their grants, their own salaries as researchers in many instances, and who are dependent on the flow of funds linked to particular policies. Decrim and what's been referred to as safe supply are major thrusts of current federal and BC provincial politics and are essentially purchasing advocates.
I remember going back to when it was just a safe injection site. I think it was the Portland Society. Was that the organization in Vancouver?
Portland Hotel Society.
Yeah, Portland Hotel Society. And they would always bring up, we've got peer-reviewed studies. And then you look, and John peer-reviewed George's study, and George peer-reviewed John's, and Mary peer-reviewed this one. And it was just a group passing it around that all have the same ideology and push for this. And I think, the public is compassionate. People have compassion for addicts. And we've been sold on whether it was safe injection sites that became safe consumption sites, that became safer supply, that became decriminalization. I think the public has a compassion and they want to help, and they're told this will reduce overdose deaths. This will reduce social ills. And then when you say to the activists and the advocates who push this, well, we tried what you wanted and it didn't work, they say, but we haven't tried it long enough, or we need to do more. And that's what they're doing now. And I look at the BC Coroner's report that comes out monthly on unregulated drug deaths in BC. And I don't know how they can continue to say we need to keep doing this. With the exception of 2019, we've gone up every single year in British Columbia. From 370 drug overdose deaths in 2014 to 2,546. I know fentanyl really hit the scene in 2016 and has been growing ever since, but the measures that society has agreed to put in place to try and get better outcomes is not getting better outcomes.
Yeah. And it's along the lines of, the tactics of the gun lobby in the U.S., that the problem of mass shootings and school shootings and so on isn't that we have too many guns, it's we don't have enough guns. Because we don't have enough guns in the hands of the right people. right? So this is very similar. And
I've heard that argument. Yes.
The reason I emphasize the money side is that this whole movement from the perspective of addiction research and what we can do to reduce, to prevent addictions, to help people overcome addictions, is completely missing from the rationale for what we're currently doing. It comes out of a whole different place, as though there was no previous literature. And the main protagonists in BC, we have a government-funded, an industry-funded center, the BC Center for Substance Use. The BC Center for Substance Use was created by people who were formerly the HIV/AIDS Center. They essentially rebranded, retitled their initiative, but appear to have preserved the same overall focus on pharmaceuticals, which obviously is integral to the progress that we've made in addressing HIV/AIDS, but is a relatively minor component of helping to prevent and treat addiction. To emphasize how sort of odd this policy thrust looks, consider that we're 8 years into a declared public health emergency in BC. The only way to perpetuate a mortality crisis is to keep putting people at risk every single day. We have no prevention strategy. It hasn't even crossed the lips of our government leaders, whether on the public service side or the elected side. Everything is focused on supply. If the war on drugs taught us anything, it should be that a focus singularly on trying to improve community health by intervening in supply is insufficient. But here we are with an entirely supply-focused strategy. Of course, it's blaming toxic drugs, not the fact that youth are growing up in despair, not the fact that people with untreated mental illnesses are increasingly on our streets and succumbing to drug addiction or in SROs, inadequate forms of housing, nothing to do with the circumstances that are modifiable. I mean, so this is back to the addiction literature. Lots of research shows that, including randomized controlled trials that I've had the privilege of leading, has shown that if we provide people with fundamentally different opportunities that involve changing their circumstances, changing where they live, changing their opportunities to engage in the workforce, to reconnect with their kids and with their families, we see dramatically different results, including crime, addiction, and suffering. But here we have this kind of odd-looking, completely supply-focused initiative. And what makes it worrisome is the people responsible were so convinced that they were correct that several of them formed their own companies while in public office and while lobbying for safe supply. This includes our former provincial health officer, who formed an opioid company, his deputy, who formed an opioid vending machine company, the chief scientific officer of our major health funding organization, the Michael Smith Foundation, who also was an HIV/AIDS researcher, co-founded the opioid company with our PHO.
So hold on. I need to stop you because I'm having trouble believing this. They founded companies to supply opioids to safe supply?
Exactly. This has been reported and is on the record. So did the director, the initial director of the BC Center for Substance Use. They all worked together on HIV/AIDS, and they were so convinced that the thought that the appearance of conflict in hindsight would be irrelevant, that they would likely be seen as the architects of a new era, a new and better era. Having worked with these individuals for many years, I'm now, of course, excommunicated from that particular tribe. But having worked with them for many years, I think they did it believing they were right. Dr. Bonnie, in her report to Ottawa asking for decrim, says that the world is seeing increases in drug-related hardships, including poisoning fatalities, and BC, and she says, BC is poised to lead the way. So there's really a lot of evidence suggesting that they really, really believed in what they were doing, that they believed that potential conflicts of interest would never rise to the point of scrutiny, but they badly miscalculated.
I'm still dumbfounded at that. That is, we were talking before you joined us off air about all the former cops and police chiefs who now own a piece of the marijuana industry, the cannabis industry in Canada. But that's legal. These are health officials forming opioid companies to supply something that we would have thought crazy just a few years ago. I interviewed Dr. Sharon Koivu a few months ago about the problem of safer supply, and she had a unique vantage point from where she is in London, Ontario. And Dr. Koivu is an advocate of harm reduction, if done right. But she said there are four pillars of drug policy: prevention, treatment, enforcement, and harm reduction. And she said, we've forgotten about the other three and we're just doing harm reduction, and that is hurting people. Would you agree with that statement?
Well, I agree that we've lost track completely of the four pillars. I also agree with your kind of query that we aren't even doing harm reduction. Harm reduction was introduced, and one of the, I say this with some sense of I guess authority. My mentor in clinical practice was a psychologist named Alan Marlatt. Alan literally wrote the book Harm Reduction and was a major force behind its advent in North America after gleaning some of the early insights from European practices. So, and I had the privilege of contributing to those books and to doing research involving harm reduction now over many years. The point of harm reduction is to be engaging people where they are, to be non-directive. One of the things we were concerned about was the practice of insisting that people had to hit rock bottom before we would engage with them, which is clearly incorrect. So we could help people make improvements without imposing demands on them, but by giving them opportunities and by listening to their own requests for assistance. What can we help you with today? We took that to the extreme in Vancouver, and here's an example of what harm reduction could be. We went up to people who were living homeless. They'd been homeless an average of 10 years. Most were struggling with very severe addictions, and all had concurrent mental illnesses, psychotic illnesses, bipolar disorder, so mood-related swings. And we asked them, hey, what can we help you with today? We weren't restricted, though. We said, look, we could go and get a meal. We could help you get your ID. We could help you get reconnected with benefits that you're entitled to. We've also got some apartments available. And these were all apartments integrated into healthy communities, so dispersed apartments. Most people said, really? Like, and in fact, they said they don't believe us, but in more colorful language. But when they realized we were serious, they said, well, yeah, I mean, where are those places you mentioned? So we offered people that form of harm reduction. They took us up step by step. Next week, we helped them furnish their apartment. We helped them figure out where to buy groceries and cook. We helped them over time to reconnect with employment. On day one, 82% of the people that we worked with, and this is a sample of 500 people, 82% listed resuming paid employment as one of their top priorities. 25% had kids under age 18, and over time, reestablishing a link with those kids understandably became a top priority. But we go step by step by step. And harm reduction as a non-coercive, volitional form of helping people has profound benefits. So that those randomized trials, which were conducted in five regions of the country, widely published, have been systematically ignored by governments. Instead, what we do in BC and what we did in response to the surge of homelessness in recent years was to double down on grouping people all together in buildings, which we showed was inferior to providing actual harm reduction and actual opportunities to reconnect with healthy communities. So, you know, this is something that has
That is the exact opposite of where harm reduction is now.
Yeah,
I'm sure you heard of the tragic shooting here in Toronto outside a community health center last summer.
Yes.
The South Riverdale Community Health Center. And it's home to a safe consumption site. And as I found out later, the federal government had brought in a so-called safe supply. And of course, that helped attract drug dealers. And that was part of what happened with the shooting. But started looking into this organization that said it's there to help addicts. And right on their website and on printed material that they would pass around, they said that they had a philosophy about being simply respectful of and to people who use drugs. No judgment, no expectations, and no desire for people to stop using drugs.
That's the key. That's the key. So I think a succinct way of saying what I was trying to get at before is that harm reduction began as something that was more like a verb, something that was ongoing and had a direction of improved health very much as its compass. And it became a series of nouns. We exchange needles, so that's harm reduction. We provide consumption sites, so we do harm reduction. It's completely become untethered from any sense of throughput, any sense of progress toward ever more improved health, which includes citizenship, connections with people, general health, all of which are attainable. And we've backed our way into some weird dystopia where in BC, again, our provincial health officer is on record in our legislature on Hansard saying people with opioid addictions don't recover. Well, if that's your belief, I mean, first of all, if that's your belief, you have no business designing policies related to addiction. But it is so grossly misinformed that, but it helps shed light on why we're in such a terrible place.
That's unbelievable that they would say that. I've met people who have recovered from opioid addiction. It's a struggle, but they do, and they can, with the right programs and processes in place. And it feels to me like right now, what we've done is taken something that you described and said, okay, well, you know, it'd be easier. Let's just make sure they've got a steady supply and keep them alive until they die. And, you know, it's aiding and abetting not only addiction, but a diminished life.
Very, very much so. I don't think it's an overstatement to sum it up that we're increasingly producing despair, and our leaders have found a way to turn despair into a profit center.
Julian, we have to take a quick break, but I know you've got some fascinating stats on places like Portugal, which people say, well, why don't we just be like Portugal and decriminalize everything? And you've got stats that will, I think, blow the socks off people. So we'll talk about that when we come back. One of the things that the activists and activists for further liberalizing drugs in Canada will always say is, why can't we just decriminalize everything like we did in Portugal? And my view is that we've got the cart before the horse in terms of how we're approaching this. So, Juliano, I want to hear your take on this. We have in British Columbia, you've gone full decriminalization, hasn't helped with the problem. You've taken, you know, been the leaders in British Columbia, especially in Vancouver, on liberalizing drug laws and policies at every turn. We're not far behind here in Toronto, and it's not helping. So what are they doing differently? Because everyone says Portugal's a success story. Have they done it completely different than the rest of us?
There's an era in Portugal's approach to drugs that is important to focus on, and it's roughly between 2000 and 2010. The global financial crisis changed social policies in around the world, including in Portugal, and the results since then changed. So if we go up to the present, the budget for centralized activities addressing addiction was cut by over 85% following 2010. And there's been a slide. But if we go back to the era that Portugal is known for, people who are interested can look at the Portuguese National Drug Strategy. It's available online, and I think it's an extremely informative document for any jurisdiction like ours that's going through a similar crisis. They said in this document that they must make social reintegration the central organizing theme. They went about doing that by, first of all, they like us in BC, were not criminalizing, air quotes, people for possession of drugs before they made the legal change. There were very few people being arrested and prosecuted. But they made the change to decriminalize possession so that police officers could more easily approach people who were obviously in distress and urge them to accompany the police officer to a dissuasion commission. So this is a place where people could sit down, they were treated with respect, and they were encouraged to follow the advice of dissuasion commissions advice that they reached in collaboration with the individual. But it's basically around, look, we know that you deserve better. We are alarmed by your using drugs in public. We're alarmed by the fact that you have no means of supporting yourself, no means of protecting yourself. We want to help you address that. We're not here to say that you must stop using drugs. We're here to say that we cannot collectively accept that that's your life. It has impacts on the community that you live in as well. How are they going to achieve that? They had apartments and places for people to move into that were acceptable, that were decent, that were safe. They had therapeutic communities that people could go to in order to practice over a period of time living without drugs. And also, therapeutic communities include a focus on trades and helping people to learn things that they can then take with them after they leave, and as the basis for, among other things, keeping themselves on the right track. So the change in the law was a relatively minor component of what contributed to their success. Their success includes a dramatic reduction in public drug use, in drug-related fatalities, and in drug-related crime. And that's really what they're lauded for. But the idea that somehow a change in law can account for that is really missing the point. And it's stunning to me that decision makers have recommended legalization or decriminalization as though that was the magic bullet. They clearly have not bothered to read the Portuguese national strategy.
Or look at what worked and what didn't in Portugal. They look at that one thing. And it's funny, you mentioned that they weren't prosecuting people for simple possession prior to making that legal change. The push for decriminalization by our health authorities in Toronto is, well, we have to end the stigma and people shouldn't be charged with simple possession. But it's right in their own application to the federal government that in 2021, the last year they had stats for when they submitted this, that there were 617 people charged with possession. And only 36 of them were charged with possession alone. The rest, it was an add-on charge to public disorder, assault, various things. And much the same as it was for marijuana prior to it becoming legal. The cops aren't going around busting you for having a small amount of drugs on you. They're busting you for something else, and then they add that on. It's back to where we started the conversation. without any tools, we're going to have the public disorder and chaos that you've experienced in parts of British Columbia, where the police just have no ability to do anything for people who are in distress, who are using drugs openly in places that will scare children, seniors, parents, students trying to go to school. So again, it is this vicious cycle where we just keep saying, make drugs easier to get, but there's no treatment. There's no prevention. It's frustrating. So what would a good model look like for you?
Well, so we, you know, the end of decriminalization or the beginning of the end of decriminalization is not a really big cause for celebration. We've essentially squandered years now and are inching our way back to a position we were in a year and a half ago, but with far greater damage socially than we had in the meantime. So the things that we need are immediate triage. We need immediate assessments of people who are at high risk. And high risk can be people are visibly using drugs. This is in encampments and in other places. In the city of Edmonton right now, there's a navigation center. People are brought from encampments voluntarily, and they have access in one place to immediate respite if they want that. A respite with their pets, respite with their kids, but they also have access to the entire suite of publicly funded services, healthcare, social support, getting your ID like right away before you leave. Indigenous supports are there for Indigenous peoples, and it's all in one spot. So we need to have an immediate integration and an assessment of people. We're losing people who are struggling with serious mental illnesses, and we need time to assess that. Then we need places to direct them. This is like the dissuasion commissions. We need things like therapeutic communities. Most of the people who are dying of poisoning are unemployed and have been unemployed for some time. They're also young, and they tend to be young men. The construction sector, by the way, we've been lied to. It's not primarily construction workers. It's primarily unemployed people. But the construction sector does play a potential role as a potential trade focus in a therapeutic community. We need to be mounting these immediately, places where people can go, get some respite, get some support, and learn trades and learn ways of earning money that they can then use after they leave. We need to dismantle our SRO empire. We need to stop
SRO,
single room occupancy hotels. Thank you. So our response to mental illness and homelessness, including addiction, has been to create buildings and whether they're old buildings, the old single room occupancy hotels that used to be used by itinerant workers, or new buildings, which are essentially towers of bachelor apartments. With consumption sites in the building. I mean, this is just further to our ability to generate money-making opportunities, development opportunities on the backs of a social crisis. So we need to get away from that and recognize that the thing that helps people recover is not simply being housed, and it's certainly not being housed in a building where everyone else is a drug user and there's a consumption site. The thing that's helped people the most has been joining healthy communities where people are treated with respect and treated as though they have responsibilities as citizens as well. People rise to that challenge.
Well, they've got people next to them who are going to work, and then you're like, oh, well, yeah, I should go to work as well, as opposed to the guy in the room next to you says, why do you want to do that, loser? I got a good score. Let's go downstairs to the consumption site.
Exactly. Exactly.
You mentioned, you know, you've mentioned several times getting ID, and I think, you know, it's such a small thing, but if you have not been around people living and dealing in these situations, they might say, well, why does that matter? But it matters tremendously, because if you've fallen that far that you're living in an encampment, which you know, we seem to just accept that people now live in tents and live in conditions that, you know, we spent decades trying to ensure never existed. If you're living in that situation, chances are you've lost your ID. You've been on the streets for so long, you no longer have it. And when you don't have ID, you can't get government services. You can't get a place to live, even if you somehow get the money.
Yeah, it's a key insight. When I was in Edmonton's Navigation Center myself, the area table really where government ID is produced and provided on site was the most popular in general, the most popular service that people accessed because of the reasons you mentioned. And you know, we need to be thinking about the pathway back. A very small outfit in Victoria supports people living rough in the city on Pandora Street and concentrated areas. And one of the services they offer are back taxes. So they'll go and help people clear off, you know, the previous years of taxes and declarations. And, you know, it might seem like a kind of an odd thing to do, but it's one of those, you know, big bureaucratic steps that essentially means that now the slate is clear. If you were to poke your head back up as a citizen, find a place to live, find a place to work, you're not going to be received by the CRA as some kind of an alien with, you know, miscreant with problems to address. You're now operating with a clean slate, and people embrace these opportunities.
And so then you've got an opportunity to access programs, including funding, refundable tax credits, payments.
Exactly. All of these things that despair and mental illness and addiction lead us away from in terms of our attention, and our loss of attention just further compounds our own problems, and we enter proverbial vicious cycles.
We haven't talked much about safer supply. It's been mentioned, but given that British Columbia is further down this road than other parts of the country, I do want to ask about it because the federal government is all in on safer supply. They have made it clear that they're going to push this forward. There is a new site that's been identified by the federal government for a so-called safer supply location in Brampton, just west of Toronto, that's causing an awful lot of anxiety in the community. Doesn't seem to matter to the local Liberal MP or other, you know, people that are pushing this. What's BC's experience been? Because when I write about it, when colleagues like Adam Szivo write about it, we're told, no, this isn't true. Everything's fine. And then you get, you know, the deputy police chief of Vancouver going before the House of Commons and saying, well, actually, most of the pills we're getting are diverted safe supply.
It's a very dangerous set of policies. It should strike everyone as sound common sense that drugs such as opioids, crystal meth, whether used alone or in combination, are harmful to human health. This is pretty, you know, abundantly established scientifically, the physiological aspects of drug-related harms are well understood. The psychological and social harms are well understood. So this is far from benign. This doesn't really have much to do with science. The advocacy for so-called safe supply doesn't have much to do with science. It has to do with other things, including financial opportunities. When we wrote a review that we've been asked by many governments to write reviews over the years, and one we wrote for Alberta's legislature, or I should say Alberta's Ministry of Health, was addressing this. We pointed out that there were some key gaps in knowledge related to what would happen, and there were some key gaps in terms of the implications for the future. What's the exit plan? How much is it going to cost per person per year? So we can look at this investment versus alternatives that have already been well costed and shown to be effective. None of these questions have been answered. So we put this review out there, and within a week, Safe Supply advocates, not claiming to be Safe Supply advocates, not divulging that they received funding related to Safe Supply, had written an open letter saying no one should read this review because it's low quality. They convened press conferences, and media, mainstream media, ate it up. Summers et al. Write low quality review. Nobody should read it. And they didn't. They didn't report on it in their coverage. They just said, well, you know, people are upset. That's news. They didn't point out that the people who were upset are funded to advocate for Safe Supply. We were further attacked. The same organization, this was centrally organized by the BC Center for Substance Use. They took the extraordinary step of beginning to contact conference organizers where I was scheduled keynote speaker, urging them to uninvite me.
Oh, man.
This is, so at that point, I knew crystal clear, this has nothing to do with science or scholarly debate. This is irrational. Why would somebody be behaving so irrationally? And it's because they've got something to hide.
You know, I'm sure you've watched some of the movies or documentaries about the opioid crisis in the States and Big Pharma's role in that. And what is shocking to me is that we've got our governments all suing Big Pharma. They settled with Purdue a little while ago. And then we turned around and we gave them contracts to provide the same drugs.
Yeah.
We've turned from labeling them as pushers and evil to becoming their pusher through our government.
Identification with the aggressor. Yeah. As you said earlier with cannabis, many people in positions of authority, especially on the elected side, are looking for their next gig. What's going to happen after I leave office? And, you know, we can speculate, but the pharmaceutical industry is a proven a sector that legislators and regulators orient to. When the Stanford Lancet Commission undertook their detailed analysis of the opioid crisis in North America, they include Canada and the U.S., they identified chiefly regulatory failures as contributing factors. And what they meant was people moving from positions in organizations like the FDA back into industry, or the other way around, or into positions in academic centers, often medical programs. And this fluidity was part of the problem, part of what gave, because it incentivizes people to be thinking, well, you know, I'm low in the polls now, but if I can grit my teeth and get to the end of my mandate, I'll likely have an opportunity to pursue work in this area or that area. And unfortunately, that appears to be part of what's happening here.
Unbelievable. So as a clinical psychologist, I'm sure you've dealt with people who have addictions, not people who are living on the street, living rough, but people who otherwise seem to have their life together. What in your experience, is there something that works with them in overcoming their addiction?
Yeah. I mean, I'm surrounded in my world by people who've experienced addictions and people who are experiencing addictions, and including a lot of work with people who go through court. And so part of our work has included the drug treatment court, the community court that operates in the downtown east side of Vancouver, and also voluntary programs. That was along the lines of what I was mentioning earlier among people who are living homeless. The things that work overall are opportunities to find and establish and nurture meaning. People, when we're experiencing addictions, one of the most frustrating, agonizing components is the experience of loss of control, an inability to control something that we know is harmful to us and often harmful to other people who we care for. And the thing that makes the biggest difference for many people are the elements, the changes that occur that require often other people. They require us to make choices, but they also, you know, if you're living homeless and you don't have opportunities for support from people around you, you are completely dependent on someone, ideally somebody representing society via our government, entering your world and offering you things that are completely reasonable, in fact, that we say people are entitled to, like safe, decent housing, like food security, like opportunities for employment. And when we provide those opportunities to people, basic opportunities, well, less and less basic, less and less guaranteed, but we've shown that it is abundantly possible to reach out to people and provide those opportunities, and they will flourish. They will. It may take time, but we will see improvements right away. We saw in the first year of our randomized trials that compared to people who received usual services in Vancouver, the people who we began assisting in 1 year had 71% fewer offenses than the people that were receiving, you know, what's currently available. 71% less crime, 45% fewer medical emergencies. And those things contribute also to the bottom line financially, which helps illustrate that intervening, the financial cost of intervening is about the same as the cost of essentially leaving people homeless. So we've run out of good reasons, good empirical reasons, good humanitarian reasons to sustain the status quo. I hope some of the silver lining in this really dark storm that we're in is that we have an immense amount of information available to guide us. We talked about Portugal. We can also talk about evidence shown in Canadian regions that the same kinds of transformations are possible, but it requires us to spend differently.
Well, it sounds like spending on hope is better than spending on despair.
Well put.
Julian, thanks so much for the time today.
My pleasure, Brian. Great talking to you.
Full Comment is a Postmedia podcast. My name's Brian Lilly, your host. This episode was produced by Andre Prue with theme music by Bryce Hall. Kevin Libin is the executive producer. Remember, you can subscribe, and please do subscribe to Full Comment on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Amazon Music. Help us out by leaving us a review, giving us a rating, and telling your friends about us. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Brian Lilly.